You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to a special edition of the podcast from FQXI's 5th international meeting in Banff, Alberta. I'm Zia Morali. Throughout the meeting, we'll be bringing you audio, video and blog posts based on the talks and conversations with our many participants here. The conference opened yesterday with a session on science's dirty secrets. Here's one of the first speakers, Paul Davis, a physicist from Arizona State University. He has looked into questions about how life got started, bringing in a quantum perspective. Davis gave a short talk about what we know, and more importantly, what we don't, about life.
Do we need new physics to explain life? And do biological systems hint at what that new physics might be? Now, the founder of this way of thinking was surely Schrödinger, who, in his famous book, What is Life?, dealt with the question of the physics, what we might call the physics of living matter. And he certainly left open, in fact, he was inclined to speculate that living matter, while not eluding the laws of physics as established up to date, is likely to involve other laws of physics hitherto unknown. In other words, that life does not somehow contradict known laws of physics, but our existing laws are inadequate to explain all of the apparently magical properties that life has. Well, this book, of course, was written a long time ago. What is an up-to-date view? Well, if, for example, we take the opinion of George Whitesides, the Harvard chemist, highly respected, is life just another sort of physical system? Well, he is open to the fact that, no, there is something special and new going on. How remarkable is life, he says? The answer is very. Those of us who deal in networks of chemical reactions know of nothing like it. So that's my preamble. I'm now going to go through seven or eight dirty secrets, depending on when I run out of time. So let me just start with dirty secret number one. All life on Earth is not known to be the same life. You'll read in textbooks that all life on Earth has a common origin and therefore is fundamentally the same. We don't know that. The reason we don't know it is because we have not yet discovered all life on Earth. Most life is microbial, and only a tiny fraction of the microbial realm has been characterized, let alone cultured and sequenced. We don't know what those little critters are. Under a microscope, microbes just look like little blobs. You can't tell by looking what makes them tick. You have to delve into their biochemical innards. When you do that, for all life so far studied, it's the same life. But because we've only studied a tiny fraction of what is out there, we can't be sure. So this opens up the possibility that in the microbial realm, there could be forms of life right here on Earth which are life, but not as we know it. Now, if we should discover a microbe which was extraordinarily different in its biochemical nature, then arguments would rage about whether, if you follow the two trees back far enough, you would indeed find that there would be a common origin. It may not be easy to separate out one from the other. For example, if we found all known life uses the same genetic code, if we found a form of life that had an alternative genetic code, then people might argue that there was a simpler precursor code that bifurcated into the two that had been found. But I'll give you one example of where it would be very hard to figure out a common origin, and that is mirror life, that life as we know it is based on left-handed amino acids and right-handed sugars. If we found a form of life with things around the other way, it would be very hard to figure out a common origin. And so it's worth going to look for such life. And indeed, there have been some limited experiments to try to find mirror life. So let me now move on to dirty secret number two. And that is that life can't, I believe, be fully understood using ball and stick chemistry. And in particular, I refer to the dawn of quantum biology. There have been a whole slew of publications in recent years, books and articles. This, if you look at here at the bottom, this talk by Jim Al-Khalili is a very good and entertaining introduction to quantum biology. Probably the expert in the room is Seth Lloyd, you can ask him about this afterwards. But there are a number of examples that have been discovered in recent years where it does seem that quantum mechanics is playing a non-trivial role in biology. Of course, I should say at the outset that in a rather trivial sense, all of biology is quantum mechanical, because biology is based on chemistry and we can't understand chemistry without quantum mechanics. But when I'm talking about non-trivial effects, I'm talking about things like entanglement, superpositions, tunneling, and so on. The example that most people seem to focus on is quantum aspects of photosynthesis. This is something that's already in the popular culture. Ian McEwan's book Solar refers to it. I'm not going to go into technical details, this is both experimental and theoretical. The other one that is sort of rather charming is avian navigation, that some birds, particularly the European robin, are able to navigate using the Earth's magnetic field. So there's an avian compass. On this compass, there is good experimental evidence that this compass depends on quantum mechanical effects, radical ion pairs in molecules, large protein molecules in the retinas of the birds that are activated, and mixing of the singlet and triplet states gives information about the orientation of the bird's eye relative to the Earth's magnetic field. You can read about it for yourself. This is not the time to go into details. The third one, which is being discussed a lot, is about flies, Drosophila, being able to not exactly sniff superpositions, but vibrational states of molecules, that the lock and key explanation of smell simply is inadequate to explain the high degree of fidelity that, in fact, all organisms seem to have. And the experiments with Drosophila involve deuterating these molecules and confusing the flies as to whether to fly left or right. So quantum biology is a field that suggests that the traditional ball and stick method of chemistry is going to be inadequate for explaining life. Before I leave that point, what we would like to know, of course, is, are these examples I've given you just the tip of a quantum iceberg, or do they suggest, as Schrödinger implied, that somehow non-trivial quantum effects are fundamental to understanding the nature of life? Is the secret of life in quantum mechanics, or has he even conjectured some sort of post-quantum mechanics? That's very unclear. If quantum mechanics gives some sort of comparative advantage, then it's no surprise the natural selection has amplified those capabilities, and so that here and there we might expect to see quantum effects. But it's unclear whether it's going to be more fundamental than that. So dirty secret number three, there just seems to be a feeling, at least in the media, that somehow life has been created in the lab, or is about to be created in the lab. I just want to knock that idea on the head. We are very, very far indeed from being able to cook up life ab initio in a test tube. Of course, there are people out there who've been trying for a long time to do this. The experiment everybody usually refers to is the Miller-Urey experiment in 1952, where the basic building blocks of life, amino acids, were made rather easily by sparking electricity through a mixture of gases thought to represent the atmosphere of the early Earth. That's easy enough to do. But just because you make the building blocks doesn't mean you're making the whole thing. It's a bit like saying, coming to Earth and seeing, say, New York City and thinking, that's amazing, how did that appear? And then after a lot of work saying, we've solved the problem. We know how to make a brick. So making the building blocks is one thing, assembling them into the extraordinarily complex and intricate structure that life represents is quite another. And yet, we see things like this all the time. Scientist Craig Venter creates life for the first time in a laboratory, sparking debate about playing God. Well, you know, what did Venter do? He just re-engineered existing life. He took a bacterium, a mycoplasma, and the instructions for running the bacterium are on the DNA. He just replaced it with his own DNA, which you can cook up, order on the internet, gets delivered by FedEx, and then you can upload it into the microorganism and boot it up, and then it runs on the new software. So it's just like taking a computer and just writing some new code and uploading it. That's not the same as making a living thing ab initio. So we see lots of this sort of stuff out there. Scientists striving to create life out of nothing. Well, there's a stupendous gulf between making the building blocks and a real, genuine living thing. And it's not the same as just reprogramming, re-engineering existing life. Data secret number four. So the textbooks will give you the impression that the nature of life is pretty well understood all the way from DNA right the way up to cells and organisms. And there is a huge, huge gap in the middle, in the mesoscopic regime. The expert in this is the late John Widham from Northwestern University, and my favorite quote of his is that everything you see in between is actually make-believe. So this is from a textbook, and we know the structure of DNA very well because you can get at it with electron microscope, and we understand the physics of DNA. We also understand chromosomes pretty well. You can see them under a light microscope. And so you've got the bottom and you've got the top, but the mesoscopic region in between is really very murky indeed. Every cell in your body has about that much of DNA. And somehow it's got to be scrunched up and folded into the nucleus. And that compactification of the DNA is an immensely complex business. And you'll see these diagrams with all of this, these windings and loops and so on. But the truth is that we really don't know or understand that. So here we have an information-rich, highly dynamic, highly complex substance, this chromatin, which is the DNA wrapped around the proteins and compactified inside the cells, but that substance is largely mysterious, and so that's dirty secret number four. Dirty secret number five. So the Darwinian principle, survival of the fittest, there is an impression that that is alone able to account for the richness and diversity of the biosphere. But I think it's simply not the case. I'm not saying the Darwinian principle is wrong, but just that it's incomplete. It's an incomplete account of the nature of life. Because in addition, natural selection can act only upon what is already there. And so in addition to determining the survival of the fittest, we have to worry about the arrival of the fittest. And I can recommend this book by Andreas Wagner, called Arrival of the Fittest, in which he discusses the relationship between genotype and phenotype. Again, there's that simplistic tendency to think that every genotype has an associated phenotype, and you change the genotype, change the phenotype. It's not true. There's a very large, the genotype space is exponentially large, and there's a very large number of genotypes that can map to the same phenotype. And so over time, the genomes will explore genotype space and send out tentacles in all these higher dimensions. And the neighborhoods of those tentacles can be systems that have very different phenotypes. And so there's already a potential in the gene pool, if you like, for very different phenotypes. And understanding how those phenotypes spring into existence when conditions change is something which is essential to understanding the full picture of evolution. So it's not sufficient to just have selection. We need to understand those aspects as well. Related to this, dirty secret number five, Lamarckism is not dead. Reports of its death are premature. And that's because of the now clear evidence for epigenetic inheritance. So let me just tell you what that is very briefly. So every cell in your body has the same genes, and yet a liver cell, a skin cell, a hair cell, these are all very different. And they're different because different genes get expressed. So that's called epigenetics, is what determines what gets expressed, as opposed to the underlying genes. And so we're very clear that during development, the gene expression unfolds in the different organs and different cell types, and that is well understood. And of course, when a cell, say in the kidney, replicates, it makes another kidney cell. It doesn't make a liver cell or a skin cell. Transmission or propagation of that epigenetic information from one, in a cell, given cell type, from one cell to the next, is well enough established. Where it becomes more controversial is whether epigenetic information can propagate from one generation to the next. And there's accumulating evidence that this is indeed the case. So what this means is that the experiences of an organism, it can affect the germline and pass on epigenetic markers from that organism to the next generation and on to the next generation. There are actually many examples of that. This is one particular paper from Nature Genetics to explain that. So let me just move on to dirty secret number six. There's little reason up to now to think that life may have happened more than once in the observable universe. It goes totally against the fashion. I should say that during this FQXI conference, I'm also having to Skype into the Breakthrough Listen conference, which is taking place in Silicon Valley. Breakthrough Listen is the $100 million project that Yuri Milner is funding to try to detect signals from extraterrestrial intelligence. And I'm a great supporter of that. I think it's a wonderful idea. But I have to say that the current fashion of supposing that the universe is going to be teeming with life is based on no evidence whatsoever. We don't know how life began. In fact, Crick, many years ago, said life on Earth seems almost a miracle, so many of the conditions for it to get going. Jacques Monod says man, somewhat sexistly, at last knows he's alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged only by chance. So the prevailing view then was that life is a stupendously improbable accident. It's so complex, so specific in its nature, that it would never have happened twice in the observable universe. And that was certainly the prevailing view in the 60s and 70s. So looking for life beyond Earth, one might as well have professed an interest in looking for fairies. It was self-evidently the case that life was a bizarre aberration, an extraordinary phenomenon restricted to Earth. But then, 20 years later, Christian De Duve was able to write that life is almost bound to arise wherever physical conditions are similar to Earth, and he calls it life is a cosmic imperative. So Darwin, it's interesting, refused to be drawn on the subject of life's origin. It's mere rubbish thinking at present of the origin of life. One might as well think of the origin of matter, he said. But the point I want to make is that if you don't know the process that turned non-life into life, you can't estimate the odds. It could be that there is a mechanism that means that that transition is really rather probable and that the universe is teeming with life. But since we don't know what that mechanism is, we can't estimate the probability. So you can't estimate the odds of an unknown process, is the point I want to make. Many people don't seem to realize this. I want to say it again. You cannot estimate the odds of an unknown process. So when journalists ask me, as they often do, how likely is it, do you think that, you know, ET is out there or there's life out there or something? I say, that question cannot be answered, because you can only answer a question, how likely is something, if you know what is the mechanism that does it, then you're in with a chance. Contrast that with the other problem, that if life gets going on another planet, how likely is it the microbes will evolve to some sort of complex intelligent radio telescope building variety? We know the mechanism that did that. It's Darwinian evolution and a few other bells and whistles added. So although we can't actually do the calculation, at least we know how to think about it. We don't know how to think about the transition from non-life to life. And that's the really big step, and that's the really big unknown factor. So that just means we can say nothing useful at all about life elsewhere in the universe. It could easily be that the odds against life forming anywhere in a Hubble volume, 10 to the 23 potential sites, is a trillion, trillion, trillion to one against. That could very easily be the case. Or it may be that it's quite likely. Just can't say anything at all. And the final dirty secret, well, actually it's the final but one, but I'm not going to go into it too much. A lot of people say, well, the fact that life started on Earth so quickly proves it can't be that hard to get going. Simply not true, as Brandon Carter pointed out in a famous lecture at the Royal Society in 1981. I'm going to stop there.
That was Paul Davies speaking at FQXI's 5th International Meeting. There will be more content to come, so keep watching the website www.fqxi.org/community for updates from myself and my podcast co-host Brendan Foster. There'll also be live tweeting from the meeting at FQXI. I've been Zia Morali.